Welcome to this month's City Talks. Today we're going to be looking at the future of urban jobs. 200 years ago, the Industrial Revolution transformed the nature of employment, with many people moving from agricultural to manufacturing jobs and from rural areas to the city. The information revolution we are seeing at the moment is likely to result in transformations of the same scale and significance. But how will the rise of automation, the shift to services, and the growth of cities around the world affect how we all make a living? And what can cities do to foster the jobs of the future? Joining me to discuss these questions, I have Ryan Avant, news editor at The Economist and author of The Gated City, and Giles Wilkes, leader writer for the FT and former special advisor to Vince Cable when he was Secretary of State for Business, Innovation and Skills. Welcome to you both. So if I can take you first, Ryan, in The Gated City, you were talking about technological change and how that was affecting jobs in the US. But one of the interesting points you made was that some of the most productive places, cities like San Francisco, didn't really seem to be growing in the way that we would ordinarily expect. Just unpack that a little bit and tell us what you were thinking about, what you were talking about in the book.
Sure. Well, the digital, the technological revolution that we've kind of seen unfold over the last generation has been very good for idea-producing cities. Places like San Francisco, New York, Boston, London. It's benefited them in a few ways. It's made it more important to be able to interact with other people when you're developing complex ideas or business models. It's also made it much more lucrative to produce digital products, whether that's kind of a financial product or a piece of software, because you can sell that all over the world to many more people. But while the economic fortunes of these cities has been improving and incomes there have been growing, we haven't seen what we saw in the 19th century, which is that dynamic places grew in population. Back in the Industrial Revolution, the big manufacturing hubs just grew explosively in terms of population, and this was great for workers. There was lots of people moving in to take advantage of these new opportunities. The populations in places like San Francisco or London, they have been growing, but not very rapidly. And instead, what we've seen is just extraordinary growth in housing costs in these places. And in America, we've seen population growing really fast in places that aren't kind of the leading edge of the technology transformation, places like, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, or Miami, Florida. And these are nice cities. They're cities where there are new jobs being created, but they're not the really high productivity, high wage jobs that we'd like lots of people to be moving toward. And the question is, what's going on? Why aren't people moving to the places where these new highly productive jobs are being created? And I think it's really comes down to the fact that we're not building the housing to accommodate them. And this is an issue in London, it's an issue in lots of big cities in the US, it's even an issue in emerging markets like India and China. The housing isn't being created in the places where it really ought to be. And so much of the potential of the economy ends up being captured by people who own housing. And that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, and I'll come to Giles, get some reflections on it. A UK context in a second, but you also talk about not only the implications obviously that has for those cities themselves and the people that either live there currently, if they're homeowners, they do well, but if those that are renting or if those that want to go and live in those cities, they face real big barriers to going in. But there's also a national economy effect and a trade-off that goes on there. Just say something a little bit about, it's not just bad for San Francisco and the people that wanted to be working there, but there's a knock-on effect for the national economy.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at the experience in lots of rich economies over the last decade or two, productivity growth, income growth hasn't been especially strong relative to historical experience. And certainly, you know, you look around at all the new gadgets we've got, the smartphones laying on the table, we would think that some of this would translate into much faster productivity growth, and it hasn't. And I think that what we're seeing in terms of people not being able to move to these really high income, high productivity places is directly linked to that fact in a few ways. I mean, you have, on the one hand, you have people moving to less productive cities to do less productive work rather than to a London or a San Francisco. And so you have that effect. But also the kind of engines of idea creation that we have in Silicon Valley, they just don't have as many brains there kind of working on the big problems. And that means that this process of discovery and of turning ideas into profitable businesses isn't as fast, isn't as dynamic, doesn't create as many new firms and new jobs. And I think if you look at the estimates that economists try to make about how much this matters, it seems like it matters an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
And economists at Berkeley looked at this and suggested that, you know, over the last 50 years, this has probably cost the U.S. something like 15% of GDP,
yeah.
which is just an enormous amount that we're missing out on. So I think it's a pretty substantial problem.
Yeah. Giles, obviously you write about this stuff, but when you were in government, you were obviously thinking about this stuff
yeah.
and advising Vince Cable at the time. So just take a reflection on from what Ryan was saying. We have similar situations in a much smaller economy, but the way that our economy plays out across different cities is not that dissimilar. We have very productive cities and obviously
yeah.
less productive cities. But your reflections on the state of play there.
What's fascinating is how, in a sense, to economic historians, how familiar the underlying problem with land is. Was it David Ricardo, almost 200 years ago, reflected on how all the returns accrue to the people who own land.
Yeah.
And land is the one lobby that governments over the years have quailed to address or to take on or have a really big fight with. We had no problem deregulating capital, and we had a massive fight but deregulated labour. Land is still the massive issue. And land is still how do you get rich. I'm sure if you went through the Sunday Times top 1,000, the people who make money, they didn't invent great technology. They didn't push the frontier out. They got the rent from the frontier being
yeah.
pushed out. So when you look at San Francisco or Cambridge, for example, sometimes you think the best thing you can do for their technology industries is simply enable more house building. Now, why was this possible in the 19th century when Manchester expanded from being virtually a village with some streams to the second biggest city in the country?
Mm.
And it must be because of the nature of the economic forces and the power that they inherit. I mean, if you have economies based 40% manufacturing, as it was at our peak, you have single big concentrations of power that can also change the political economy around them. So a massive factory town can also say, look, I need housing. I need to be able to push out the planning. What we now have are agglomerations of information, network effects, lots of smaller companies normally. Okay, you have your Googles and your Facebooks, but Google and Facebook can't really boss San Francisco. Arm can't boss Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, what they have is they have a great deal of high-skilled, opinionated people who embody all of that economic value. But those are the sort of people who probably vote against. Once they're in, they vote against extra housing. So you have a very different political economy in cities, which has been exacerbated by, well, in this country at least, the removal of political power from cities. So even if you could have enlightened Joseph Chamberlain types who really want to boost their city, they don't have the powers to do it, and they don't have the incentive to do
no.
it. Which when you ask them, what was Vince Cable thinking about? One of the ideas he was keenest on in government, which went a certain way and then died, was land auctions, where you give the local authority a massive incentive in the economic value of its land going up when it permits development. As it is, the incentives to permit development in the UK at a municipal level are weak to non-existence.
Yeah.
I mean, you will have studied them at Centre for Cities. Things like the new homes bonus or business rate retention, these are tiny little margins for error. And compared to the loud, vocal, pitchfork-waving opposition you'll get to development. So until we get thorough change to the incentives and the power structures in cities, I'm not sure that they'll be able to make these economic forces speak with the voice they
yeah.
should, which is to say, I want human capital resources and therefore
yeah.
I want land.
That's a good point. But in the US, there are stronger development incentives for cities to grow their tax base either through residents and or through the business base. So are we in a similar situation there where in San Francisco or New York that those development incentives are still not strong enough to overcome, you know, homeowners and that don't want to see this happen?
I mean, one thing you do see in the US is that it varies across the country. So there are places in the country where the interests are aligned to allow a lot of new housing growth. It's not always, you know, housing growth that's right in the center of the city. I mean, Houston builds a lot of housing. It builds a lot of housing because it does most of it, on and on out into the sprawl.
Mm-hmm.
But in a place like Silicon Valley, the dynamic is very much as Giles describes in London, which is that you've got someone living in Palo Alto, and you know it's good for them when new engineers move in. That makes their community more economically vibrant. On the other hand, a lot of their wealth is tied up in their house, and they just have a very strong interest, an overriding interest, really, in making sure that that value doesn't erode. And so I think, you know, overcoming the homeowner incentives is just an incredibly difficult problem. And I don't know if we have a great solution for it. I mean, there are ideas, but so far the kind of most successful way to get around the problem seems to be trying to build around the problem, to come up with satellite cities or other ways to simply bypass the homeowners.
Yeah. Well, one of the ways that London, I suppose, has tried to deal with constraints within London and around London is to, you see development hopping into places like Milton Keynes or in places like Reading or, you know, slightly further afield, even Brighton, I think, you know, you sense that you can see there's a hopping off effect from people that are no longer in the London economy. So there's different ways of trying to deal with it, but all of it feels a bit unsatisfactory.
And you get a clamour for more transport in investment, which is slightly more popular. People don't like it when it's going on, but nobody says, I hate having a better road or more rail. And you see that happening in particular in London. The London cluster will be helped by Crossrail and various other upgrades. But, I mean, what's also interesting is how much it still matters, because the other prediction you might have made if you knew a little bit about the way the future was unfolding 50 years ago was, why does physical brain concentration matter so much? Yeah. Why is it bumping into a wine bar in Cambridge so important to the guy who founded autonomy? I mean, surely, I mean, we were talking before the recording started, people tweet way more often than meet nowadays.
Yeah.
So why do they have to be in the same corner of Palo Alto if their job is exchanging code and opinions? But amazingly, it does. I mean, I'm sure it's been written, the death of distance and the fact that it didn't die has been written many times earlier.
No.
Probably Ryan's book is the place to read about why concentration still matters. But it's astonishing to me as a journalist, because journalists get together, produce something of value in one spot. Despite being wildly scattered, nobody says, why are they not in the same room together?
Yeah.
Only for one leader conference a day is it ever important.
No, quite. And you talked a little bit earlier on, Ryan, about, and we certainly got this issue in the UK, you know, since the recession, very good job growth, employment growth, very good, relatively stagnant until quite recent wages, and certainly, I think, flatlining still, or some uptick on productivity growth. Just, is that a similar situation in the US? And I suppose then the question is, you know, when we're trying to resolve these challenges, I wouldn't want to overplay its significance, but how important are cities and, you know, the environment in which these kind of jobs and these interactions take place or don't, to thinking about how we, you know, we reignite productivity growth?
Well, I think over the last few years, there's been kind of this dark macroeconomic cloud hanging over a lot of rich countries that isn't necessarily related to cities. But we're starting to get out from under that now, though, and we're still seeing kind of disappointing wage growth, not necessarily the growth of productivity or even employment that we'd like to see. And so then you start to sort of look a bit more at these long-term structural factors that have been holding back growth. And certainly cities' future enormously large in that, as does innovation. You know, we can look at the role that slow growth in places like, if you look at San Francisco, over the last few years, I mean, employment has been growing pretty rapidly. It's been growing at about 3% a year. And it's striking to reflect on that, and then on the fact that in parts of the country, the unemployment rate is still in excess of 10%. Mm-hmm. And they're really, that's a breakdown in kind of the way the economy is supposed to work in places where people are, you know, at least ostensibly, free to move. So I think until we sort of bridge that gap, we have to say that these geographical differences are creating barriers to growth and innovation.
Yeah, similar situation in the UK is part of it. Is that Cambridge isn't growing as quickly as we would like, London isn't growing as quickly as it could. Is that in some way revealing itself in productivity growth, or not really?
Well, I mean, with the caveat that the productivity issue is a sort of Rorschach test that always reveals the prejudice of the people. I'm one who sort of memorised Brian's saying, try overshooting for once. And that I think a lot of it was endogenous. If you sap spending power out of an economy, you'll start finding that everyone's a bit less productive. And some of those effects will last for a very long time. So let's find out what overheating's like again first before giving up on productivity. But I think this issue predates, by some way, the recent fall in productivity. I remember, you probably remember as well, 2008, a policy exchange pamphlet by Tim Loinig.
Indeed.
Suggesting effectively that Northerners give up on their own cities and come down to the south where it's much more productive. And this was spun in a somewhat hostile manner for the Conservative Party at the time and caused a great fuss. But it's effectively what you're saying there. You know, if there's an agglomeration of economic activity where people are crying out for skills and there are people sitting around elsewhere, why prioritise place over people?
Mm-hmm.
However, I do know that some of Tim's subsequent work has also found that places do well where they have skills.
Yes.
And so when accepting that a place is unproductive intrinsically, as if there's none of these variables can be shifted, would be, as well as politically, rather unrealistic, a little defeatist. So can more be done to boost the skills of particular areas, particularly if maybe some economic activity is a bit more mobile than it ought to be in the days of David Ricardo. So I think they need to move on to other ways that cities can make themselves attractive as well as just loosening up their labour laws. They need to say, well, why is this place a really pro-growth environment?
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of economic activity is quite easily migratable towards people.
But you know, if you kind of look at the gap between Middlesbrough and London or something like that, and we still get angry letters from people in Middlesbrough because we said much the same thing that Professor Loinig did. It's all well and good to ask people to move. Some people never will because they like where they live.
Yeah, however, their grandmother lives there.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But then you also have to say, what's the advantage to someone moving to London if the cost of entry in terms of housing is just so extraordinary? How much of a wage boost do you have to be able to count on to counteract that? And for a lot of people, it's just prohibitive. I mean, it doesn't make sense. They're not going to be better off after they move, even if they do get a big raise, just because the housing is so expensive. So then we have to talk about what the right way to address that is. And I think certainly building more is one of those one of the solutions. But you make an interesting point. Is there a way to upgrade the skills base or to somehow make these other cities more productive? And I don't think, you know, you can't turn every city into a London or a Silicon Valley, as much as we'd like to try. But maybe you can build a Northern powerhouse. I don't know. I don't know if the enthusiasm for that is overdone or not. But
And there's the question of how much it becomes. I mean, we're talking here about incentives a lot of the time, in that what mobile businesses want, as much as the sort of physical attributes of a place, is they want to know they're dealing with the local leadership that is really going to have their interests in mind. I mean, a good anecdote I always repeat from my time with Vince was that Amazon, I think, told us about how in Leipzig they decided they wanted a fulfillment centre there. You know, these places employ 5,000 people, so with multipliers and so forth, you're talking a really significant boost. They spoke to the local government in January and got permission in February, and already infrastructure and all sorts of health, creches and so forth, had been put in by the middle of the year, and the thing was built in November. Try asking them about what it's been like trying to deal with Birmingham or the Wirral or other places they've tried to do it, where I think another of the stories they said was that some place up north didn't refuse to give them permission because the parish council was on holiday and that was it. And they didn't have any incentives. And the trouble is, all of this is self-fulfilling. If you want to be, if you're a thrusting, active kind of bureaucrat or politician who wants to get ahead and improve things, you go to Westminster nowadays. Mm. That's where the power is. That's where the glory is. You never hear a local politician on the Today programme explaining what he's doing about the story. Yeah. It always goes straight up to Whitehall. So until that nexus is broken, which maybe Osborne's Northern Powerhouse will start to do, even if there isn't very much substance underneath it, if it's starting to tell people, you know what, it's going to be your responsibility now, you might start seeing companies looking there and going, maybe I'll have more fruitful conversations.
Yeah. I want to turn to another point, which both of you have written extensively about, and again is one of those sort of topics that seems to divide people into one of two camps, and this is automation of the economy. And you know, on the one hand, there seems to be a camp that says every job bar one or two will essentially be done by a robot, and in some ways that might free us from the alienation of labour and we'll all be able to have free time and do what we want. But there's a serious kind of concern that many jobs will be lost to robots and automation, and what does that mean? Ryan, just give us a sense as to where you are in that debate. I mean, and how optimistic or pessimistic you are on the rise of robots, and whether we should really be concerned about that.
Well, I think we should be concerned about it. We shouldn't be concerned because we think all the jobs will go, or because we think the robots will take over. Not yet, anyway. I think that the main difficulty it's creating for societies now is kind of a hollowing out of the workforce. And you have a whole swathe of jobs that used to be kind of middle skill jobs that were things like some manufacturing work, but also kind of clerical work, a lot of office work, back office work. And those are the things that have really been displaced by more powerful computing and automation and robots. So for much of the last decade or two, that's actually been pretty good for skilled workers doing kind of non-routine sort of jobs in management or in technology or finance. I think what we're going to see over the next decade is that more and more of those white-collar jobs are under threat. But still, the people who are in, working in London are probably going to be okay in the sense that that their jobs will be all right. The work they do is complex enough and kind of it's too difficult to automate, essentially.
Mm.
Now, the question is, where does that leave everyone else?
Mm.
And I think you can envision a world in which there is room for people with lower skill levels to succeed and kind of find satisfactory work in this world, if we can accommodate them in the city. I mean, if you look at a lot of the jobs that are created in Silicon Valley, a bunch of them are in startups, but a bunch of them are also in kind of funny little businesses that serve the people who work at startups,
mm-hmm.
either in kind of a very basic role, kind of taking care of their laundry or walking their pets or doing their personal shopping for them. Or, you know, being a barista or starting kind of an artisanal cheese shop, the sorts of things that appeal to these these professionals. And those kinds of jobs can employ a lot of people. They won't necessarily employ them at really high wages. And so for this all to work, there's got to be housing for them, there's got to be transport for them, there's got to be a quality of life that's good enough that they can live in these productive places and still be all right. And I think that's going to be the challenge, is making sure that cities work for people who are earning seven figures a year and are going to cash out with their new startup, and also the people who walk their dogs.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Josh?
I was wondering whether Ryan or I would mention first Keynes's essays for his grandchildren, where he envisaged this. And it was people forget what a bold call it was, because it was as the Great Depression was going on. He said, well, you know what, at some point we're going to be so much richer, we're going to be wondering what to do with all of our time. And he got it wrong, as you'd expect from somebody who went on to invent the Arts Council. He thought that people would spend too much of their time just sitting around enjoying art. But there's been a recent article in the FT looking at this, and why was he wrong? And in theory, when people say the rise of the robots, it sounds very threatening, but what we're talking about is increased productivity. The productivity frontier going out, thanks to capital becoming ever more pervasive and productive, that's meant to be good news. That's what economic growth is meant to be about, being able to do more with less. But the trouble is, work, as well as providing production of the stuff we need, is also meant to provide incomes to people and a sort of fulfillment. And those are the two that we're really, really struggling with. Either you'll need very aggressive ways of redistributing the value that comes from all these robots, because it's inherently likely that capitalism means it will concentrate in the hands of a few people. The guys who come out with a robot that can take over half of these middle office jobs will own them and will be able to keep all that value. Either they are most phenomenal philanthropists, or more likely the government's going to have to come after them and give those incomes to other people. And I haven't seen a government like that on the horizon for a long time.
Do you think, I wouldn't want to overplay his intervention, but it's interesting your point as well. Do you think Osborne's announcement to raise the minimum wage is an attempt to try and deal with this issue?
I agree with the economist.
Artificially boost wages below, above what they would ordinarily be if we just left the economy.
I tend to agree with the economist line on this.
Okay.
I think he made two terrible interventions.
Right.
Tax credits worked.
Yeah.
And they boosted the supply of labour, it made it worth it. And raising the minimum wage doesn't, it cuts the demand for labour. So you cannot regulatorily increase the envelope of money going from capital to labour. You can only shuffle it around.
Yeah.
You might hope at the margin it gives a bunch of firms an incentive to do things that enhance productivity. But there are good and bad ways of doing that. You can do it the French way, where you just end up with fewer people sitting on machines and hogging the slightly more resources and looking more productive. I think it takes supreme optimism to think that this is going to have a market effect, and people have not yet absorbed how extraordinary it is that Conservative government is proposing effectively to set the wages for a fifth of the country.
Yeah, quite.
It's just off the scale.
So if you're not able to raise the wages directly of those that are on lower pay, on the downside, I suppose, of automation, you were suggesting, Ryan, then what we really need to be thinking about is reducing cost of living. so it costs less to live in places, to travel around places, to access basic services in places. How would we do that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's, sorry,
go ahead. No, go on.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's, if you, and I agree that, you know, in a world in which automation is becoming ever easier, the last thing you want to do is to make less skilled labor more expensive. So that sort of leaves you with two big levers. One, I think, is more generous wage subsidies, and that's going to be the inevitable direction of policy.
Right.
And the other is reducing the cost of living for people. And you can do that by having the state provide more services to people out of general taxation. And, you know, healthcare in Britain is very cheap. In the U.S., it's not so cheap. You know, if the U.S. were better providing that to low-income people, that would be a good thing for them. But we're also seeing the possibility of kind of things that are provided by the market becoming cheaper and cheaper. And, you know, some of that is entertainment. It's yeah. much more cheaper than it ever used to be. You can sort of go to YouTube and spend hours without spending a dime, whereas before you might have had to go and spend a bunch of money at the movie theater. But then you know, there are also very difficult kinds of things that people need for which it's hard to bring costs down. And something like education or housing certainly falls in that category. Maybe technology solves that problem. You know, maybe we get really good at providing cheap online education. But people are still going to have to pay rent. And you keep coming back to that. That's the difficult egg to crack.
Yeah, this is amazing how often one keeps coming back to land. It does remain extraordinary.
Ricardo was onto something, wasn't he, Harry?
He was, and that people, you can provide that. And I agree very much with Ryan's insight that an awful lot of what we wanted has become incredibly free, cheaper and cheaper, and then virtually free. I mean, you can entertain yourselves without spending money all week. And it might be an explanation for why this broad trend towards people having less fulfilling work lives in large swathes of society hasn't come alongside a crime wave. That is what people would have predicted 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But they didn't predict Twitter and YouTube and the rise of gaming. And the trend in crime has been absolutely extraordinary. So these are like hygiene factors. They're removing bad things from people's lives. So it would be bearable to have a world in which they're not effectively working at a more productive or interesting or fulfilling world than barista. But it still feels that the motivation for taking on education or it will be missing. I don't quite see what will be the raison d'etre for many lives if you find that actually everything is more productive done by a machine. So I don't think policymakers have come near it. And insofar as they are making big calls, they're moving in the opposite direction to the one Ryan's just described. The state is stepping back from providing services, stepping back from wage subsidies. I don't think there's a plan there right now. And I don't know whether cities will provide the answer. That just localising more the decision for this dilemma, it still doesn't erode the dilemma.
No, I mean, these are sort of, well, these are macro global trends in many respects that happen to play out in cities or manifest themselves in cities rather than cities being an agent and able to really deal with those sorts of things. So where does that leave the city policymaker, I suppose? London, San Francisco, you know, you look at their economy on the one hand, ever more successful, ever more important in a national sense, but at the London level, ever more polarisation. You know, since very clear polarisation now between those that are very rich and those that are essentially quite poor, and you can only increasingly live in London if you are one or other, and the very poor or the poor element is obviously some form of subsidisation, particularly of housing in some shape or form.
It's interesting, I mean, have you reread The Affluent Society recently?
I haven't.
Because that phrase, is it public squalor makes private affluence?
Mm.
And he thought this was a problem in the late 50s.
Yeah.
And at least they had a belief in muscular government then, which turned out to be the answer. Now, either we need to hope that somehow quite big government comes back to deal with this, because there are still a lot of unmet needs out there and there's still a lot of unused resources. So you'd have thought there'd be some way of bringing them together. But if they can't be brought together by a big government, can they be brought together at a local level?
Yeah.
Perhaps that's where your local vision is coming.
Interesting.
I mean, it's a very difficult balancing act for local government leaders, and I think the temptation is to use, I think, you know, the demand is for them to use what power they have to try to solve these problems. The question is, how do they do it? And I think you see these tensions just playing out fantastically in the form of Bill de Blasio in New York City, who is moving in several different directions. And one is to kind of the very populist effort to kind of boost up the incomes of lower-income people, to protect various occupations, But at the same time, he's also enabling a lot of construction. And I think, you know, you see these are the two impulses. One is to just say the way we're going to solve this is by allowing new people to come in, to create space for innovation, and actually to kind of bring the rich in and then skim as much as we can off the top to try to fund things for the poor. And on the other hand, there's a policy that I think motivated a lot of people in the 50s, which is to try to take people who are poor and somehow transform them into to richer people by moving them to state-provided houses and things like that. And I'm not sure that's the right way to go. But there will be different approaches in different cities. I think the hope is that a lot of people see outsiders, people who don't yet live in their city, as someone who can bring more to that local economy and help people, and so that you make space for them to move in and create jobs.
Yeah, I think it's a great, interesting point, not least at the minute, you know, when talking about migration and immigration. You know, one of the things that we were very clear on is saying, you know, those cities that have seen an expansion, an increase in their immigration problem, that's a thing to be celebrated, and you know, it's a sign of success, well, I think in many respects, rather than being a concern. But that's not necessarily the way that, you know, the populations of some of these cities feel. But being open to the outsider, both in terms of people and ideas, I think is critical. But actually, you know, 80% of the migrants in the UK live in cities, 40% of those, or half of those, live in London. You know, there's an interesting spatial dimension to where migrants then ultimately place themselves over time. But Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not a new problem.
No.
Hostility to immigration. One, I mean, and so it's easy to sort of see cycles, or it's always the same problem. One thing that's going on underneath, though, that will change these the facts on the ground, if you like, is the demographic change. So maybe people will start accepting outsiders when they start seeing their populations falling. I mean, we did a big read in the FT recently about Germany. Mm. Now, Germany is more welcoming towards immigration for all sorts of complex and reasons, a lot of them historical, but they also have villages that are falling short. And you see the same in France. France had the earliest demographic transition of any country in history. Something about the shock of the revolution meant they stopped having kids earlier.
Right.
So they had four times our population before Napoleon, and now they're about the same. They started around 1820. So there are villages all the way through France which are underpopulated, and where you would hope that people start saying, hey, I'd love to see some people coming in and living in these houses. Now, it's not going to be a problem for Britain for some reason. I mean, Britain seems to have a more positive demographic trend, but around the world you're going to start seeing people saying, I need ways of drawing people in. And that might change the dynamic around this whole question of land.
And yet, if anything, I mean, it's probably interesting to get your reflection from a US point of view, right? If anything, we seem to be making it particularly more difficult now for a highly skilled migrants and either as students or post-grad students to both come to the country in the first instance and to stay and make their way.
I'd love to try and come up with a clever academic. It's just the dumbest policy the government has come out with, and it reiterates it every couple of months.
Yeah.
You cannot imagine a dumber big policy than the immigration cap and everything that has led from it. It's very difficult to put oneself in the mind of somebody who says, hey, this is a good idea.
But it's very clearly a political policy politically led rather than economically.
You know, I mean, someday I'd love to write the book. If I had Ryan's way with writing books, I would try to write the book about how policy is not designed from technical or even political reasons. The tens of thousands target came up because Damien Green once said, you know what, it'd be good if it was down at tens of thousands. And Cameron said, that's it. That would be my commitment.
That was it.
So that is what we're tied to. And that is why we have daft policies sending talented people overseas the moment they set foot here. So it makes no sense, and hopefully the British people will come round to supporting a more sensible policy one day.
No, quite. Yeah. Right.
It's an absurd, unforced error. And as an immigrant in this country, it's one that which I'm particularly sensitive to. Yeah. I mean, you would think that also that the place where opposition to immigration would be highest would be in a place like London, where housing is scarce, and so it's very obvious to everyone that as more people come in, housing becomes more expensive. But in fact, people in London tend to be by and large very pro-immigration in my experience. I think because it's such a cosmopolitan place, it's so clear the way that immigrant communities.
How is it in the States? How is it in the States? Do they have the same dynamic where it's the deep? So I imagine the centre of the country doesn't have a lot of immigrants, but is still as hostile, or what, how is it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the hostility tends to come from places that aren't big metropolitan areas with large immigrant communities. You know, New Yorkers, by and large, tend to feel, you know, that
yeah.
immigration is a good thing for obvious reasons. And I'm not sure exactly why that is. But it is the places, you know, if you look at kind of flyover country, as they call it, that's where you have a lot of shrinking cities, where they could use an influx of kind of new talent from abroad, and it's hard to convince people of that.
Mm. It's very odd.
Yeah. Thinking about the future, I mean, you both said, I mean, if Keynes gets it wrong, then, you know, we ought to be wary about forecasting the future.
No,
there are trends and issues that we, you know, we have no real idea how they will play out. But in a sense of thinking about, you know, the urban agenda, I suppose, Ryan, in a sense you were saying very much at the start that, you know, the way that the economy has changed increased the returns to skills, increased the returns to innovation being very much at the technological frontier, particularly in economies like the UK and the US, set to continue, you know, in a sense that, or do we see some reversion, you know, this sense that, you know, you hear a lot about reshoring and bringing, you know, more production back to, you know, to places like the UK or more to the US?
I think for the near future, we should very much expect cities to continue to be hugely important and a place that is shielded from the kind of most negative effects of technological change for a few reasons. I mean, one is whenever you have lots of new technologies coming onto the scene, you have to figure out what to do with them, how to translate them into things that people want, how to build businesses around them. That's a very complex process that it really helps to have people in a room talking to each other. It's the communication of complex ideas that makes cities work, I think. In that sense, cities are going to be really important. I think the other thing that we've seen that's been really interesting is the way that new technologies have made it more attractive to be in cities. I mean, something like Uber really makes city life a lot easier in a lot of ways. And you have a lot of these kinds of services. Airbnb is another example. Different apps that help you find what you're looking for, or meet other people.
Yeah.
All of these sorts of social networks make it easier to find a way around and take advantage of all the resources in cities. And so as we see more and more of that, I think we will see the return to being in cities increase. Now, kind of the killer app, the thing that would destroy cities, I think, is kind of effective telepresence. And maybe one day that will just, you know, maybe we'll have our robots roll into these central offices and we'll all live on a farm somewhere. But, you know, people have been talking about how telecommuting is going to change the economics of cities for decades. It just hasn't happened.
Yeah. The future rosy for cities in the medium to, or the short to medium term?
No, I think so. I'm an optimist that human beings learn. So, for example, the development that you see along where the Centre for Cities offices are, along the South Bank, it was appalling after the war. They got it wrong, and now they're getting it right. It's becoming a great buzzing place to be. I recently came back from holiday. I spent a few days in Boston. Fantastic city. And even if you have the most amazing telepresence, you want to be around it. People like being around people. And it doesn't have to be broken down to reasons of economic agglomeration. I think people enjoy the culture. I think Ryan makes a very good point about innovations like Uber, which are naturally drawn to economies of scale. You need to have a certain thickness of market. And we cannot anticipate what next innovation will need a thick market, but the thickest markets will always be in the cities.
Yeah.
I mean, and I for one, I'd love to be in a world where people didn't have to own as many cars. I think that could be a fantastic innovation.
Mm.
And when people say how great it is living in the country, I wander into the Cotswolds occasionally, and there's just Range Rovers everywhere. You'd think it's an alien invasion, this beautiful countryside, and just people dump Range Rovers. Why? Because you cannot live without one of these down
there. Yeah.
Whereas in the city, I've never paid the congestion charge in 15 years. I've got other ways of getting into London.
Yeah.
So I think there's a huge and rosy future for cities, and it's great news for everybody.
Yeah.
Because they're opening and welcome places.
So on those sort of optimistic notes, let me just go back right to where you started. So I wonder whether you think that whilst the future is urban for the short medium run, at least, Ryan and you, Giles, places like San Francisco, places like London, in a sense, sowing the seeds of their demise. In a sense, you know, no city is the right, the inalienable right to be successful. Even if, you know, on aggregate, cities will be successful, some rise and fall, as we, you know, as we know through history. I wonder whether you worry about, like others do, that, you know, London's reaching its tipping point where the cost of living is just so prohibitive now, or the economy is kind of skewed towards certain sectors, that ultimately, you know, this will do for London, and, you know, there'll be, well, that may produce opportunities for elsewhere or not.
I think we're a long way from that point. I mean, I think the thing that really puts a city at risk is kind of a monoculture, where there's just not the diversity, the economic diversity, or the intellectual diversity, or the human diversity. Because that's the sort of thing that allows you to adapt, to come up with new ideas, to embrace new technologies. And when you look at cities that have really fallen on hard times, it wasn't even just manufacturing cities. It was manufacturing cities that were overwhelmingly concentrated in kind of one particular skill set, one particular industry, and they struggled to adapt. And so there is a risk, I think, and maybe it was easier to see before the financial crisis, for instance, with the finance industry. There was a risk that finance, for instance, so dominated a city and made it such a monoculture that if the fortunes there turned, the place would be in trouble. I think we're a long way from being in that place. What we do need to worry about is these sorts of places crowding out all those who aren't kind of already successful. A place can be nice and rich and adaptable and still not have room for those who have something to offer. And that would be really bad, I think, for national economies, if those engines of mobility stopped working. Mm. And that, I think, is the big concern. Mm.
Yeah, I'd echo that. What's astonishing about London? I mean, it does have its problems. It'd be great if it, in economics jargon, more of the adjustments it needed to changing forces were quantity, not price. So more houses being built when people come there rather than the prices going up.
Yeah.
There's a lot of flow within there. The price goes up so much that you can buy a palace out in the country,
indeed.
So people shift. So even though it looks stagnant and silted up, there's a lot going on. But what's astonishing is the resentment. I mean, the party leader that I was nominally serving, Nick Clegg, used to write about how, you know, London is sort of squatting atop and smothering the rest of the country. And that I find astonishing.
Although it's a widely held sentiment, not only from...
Yeah, it's not just him. We have Philip Stevens, our very well-respected commentator, wrote about how sort of London should have this sort of big wall put around it and secede or something like this. And it's extraordinary how many people think it's zero-sum, whereas if anything in economics isn't zero-sum, it's the economics of agglomeration. The things get better when you concentrate things. London is not sucking resources away. London is a good thing for everyone in this country. And those sort of political resentments shouldn't be allowed to fester.
Charles, you were on the receiving end of our pleas, I suppose, although you didn't need much convincing that. Our national policymakers, particularly those interested in the economy, should be given much more consideration and more significance to, you know, the urban centres within their nations. Yes, no. How do we do that?
In the US in particular, it's a huge challenge because the kind of structure of the national government was such that it gave outsized influence to rural states. Mm-hmm. So if you're from Wyoming, where there's about 500,000 people, you get 2 senators. If you're from California, which has 36 million people, you get 2 senators. And so there's a lot of rural influence in Washington that doesn't want to pay tax or that it goes to fund high-speed rail, even though ironically it's the metropolitan parts of the country that are kind of outsized contributors to public coffers. So I think that's a hard thing to get around. Where we could probably learn something from London is in the creation of kind of metropolitan institutions of government that have the interest of, say, all of Washington, D.C. or all of the New York metropolitan area in mind, and that plan accordingly, and then also kind of use the leverage of the whole metropolitan area to kind of try to get change in Washington. Because as it is right now, kind of where I lived before I came to London was Washington. You have the Virginia government, you have the Maryland government, you have the District of Columbia. No one really has the interest of that whole metropolitan area in mind. And so that means that they just can't have any pull in Washington. And then also, the kind of, you know, when you build a new metro line, it goes out toward one state, because that was the state that wanted to build it. There's no integration there. And I think that the example of kind of London, the London metropolitan area, is one that we can learn from.
Well, and hopefully in the next few years we'll have some more examples in Greater Manchester and some of our other big cities, but we wait to see the detail of those sorts of things. But Charles, just a kind of final reflections, thinking about, you know, the urban interaction with the national. I mean, you were on the, as you say, you were in the advising the Secretary of State for Business Innovation and Skills, and we often came and talked to you about you should think about cities and, you know.
And you know what? You were pushing on an open door in the end. And I think in its fumbling way, the government found the model for local governance that it wanted. When, if you'll have documented this over the years, but they've experimented with the stuff before the RDAs and then and local authority levels. There's been that review that Heseltine harps on about that suggested having 40 or 50 of them. We tried all sorts of models. The local enterprise partnerships, which were a very sort of new Cameroonite idea that didn't work. And then city deals arrived. And Clegg and Clark and these important government ministers in charge of this agenda suddenly realised it was something that was really working, that they were dealing with an economic area that made sense, that had often a reasonably well-defined leadership and a good understanding of what it needed. And because it worked, the resources started flowing that way. And now you have the announcements that municipal mayors are going to be accepted by a lot of these areas, and that Osborne in return is going to start offering powers and perhaps even resources. So I think it's one of the slight signs of optimism in British politics right now that the city's agenda has been pushed and is being accepted. I think you guys deserve a fair amount of credit for that.
And on that optimistic note, my guests today have been Ryan Avond and Charles Wilkes. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.